think the development of identity is an important part of the process of liberation, we shouldn't be dogmatic about what forms that identity takes.
Sometimes a man and a man love each other very much, or a woman and a woman. And if they love each other enough, they may have sex with each other. That's what being gay is.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. UN testimony details abuses in India, Amnesty documents persecution in Ecuador, and the war on terrorism's toll on third world queers. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending April 13th, 2002. The United Nations Commission on Human Rights, for only the third time in its history, heard testimony this week on the abuse of sexual minorities. At issue was recent police sweeps of parks in India, which have netted AIDS prevention outreach workers. Indian attorney and gay activist Aditya Bandyopadhyay charged that police there used the sodomy law to harass and extort money from gays, to arbitrarily arrest and imprison them, and that those detainees are tortured while in custody. He said that while he was representing a group of arrested AIDS workers known as the Lucknow Four, he himself was closely monitored by city police and received a number of death threats. He said that while his clients were in jail, they were repeatedly abused and beaten, denied food and medical treatment, and forced to drink sewer water. Bandyopadhyay's appearance was sponsored by the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, the International Lesbian and Gay Association, Switzerland's Pink Cross, the World Organization Against Torture, Amnesty International, and the International Service for Human Rights. His testimony was well attended, and three of the UN's human rights special rapporteurs also spoke. Asma Jahangir, special rapporteur on extrajudicial arbitrary and summary executions, said, "There are lesbians and gays in every country of the world, and I believe there is no country in which they do not face abuse."
Human rights watchdog Amnesty International this month issued an extensive report on police abuse of gays, lesbians, and transgenders in Ecuador, despite the national constitution there explicitly prohibiting sexual orientation discrimination. Amnesty documented harassment of activists, arbitrary detentions, and torture of sexual minorities while in custody. Most of the cases cited occurred in the cities of Quito and Guayaquil. Amnesty charges that authorities in Ecuador have taken no action to end police abuses and notes that the new chief of police for Guayas and Galapagos province has publicly expressed homophobic views.
A Muslim leader's anti-gay remarks were protected religious speech, a Rotterdam court found this week. In May, Moroccan immigrant Imam Khalil El-Moumni told a Netherlands national TV audience that homosexuality is a contagious disease that threatens society. That broadcast was directly linked to a sharp increase in complaints of anti-gay discrimination last year, according to the Netherlands National Association of Anti-Discrimination Bureaus and Reporting Points. More than 50 groups and individuals filed complaints that El-Moumni's remarks were inciting hatred. That spurred prosecutors to file criminal charges against him, even though he had later made a public apology. The Rotterdam judge agreed that the remarks were discriminatory, but declared the imam should not be convicted because he spoke as a cleric and based his remarks on the Quran. Prosecutors intend to appeal the ruling. If convicted, El-Moumni could face a fine equivalent to $1,000. The Netherlands parliament is currently considering a bill to increase sentences for bias-motivated crimes.
In what's believed to be a national first for Canada, a school board has been officially held responsible for failure to protect a student from anti-gay harassment. British Columbia's provincial human rights tribunal ordered the North Vancouver School District to pay $4,000 Canadian to former student Azmi Gibran, who was repeatedly abused by other students throughout grades 10, 11, and 12. The Handsworth High School principal called Gibran's harassment the most extensive he'd ever seen, but the vice principal said the school lacked the resources to stop it. The tribunal agreed that the school district lacked tools and training to cope with the problem, but noted that it had never sought expert assistance until after Gibran filed his human rights complaint.
In the northern Nigerian state of Jigawa, a gang of students last week beat to death a classmate they believed had had sex with younger boys. State police have so far arrested 14 suspects from the government science secondary school in Birnin Kudu for the death of 22-year-old Inua Yakuba. To date, the investigation has determined that the group rousted Yakuba from his bed and dragged him to a bush for the fatal beating.
To raise awareness of harassment and discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender students, nearly 1,800 high school and college campuses in each of the 50 United States this week observed the 7th annual Day of Silence. Participants vowed to remain silent for 9 hours, including the school day, making their point by distributing cards with statistics on campus homophobia that read, "My deliberate silence echoes that silence which is caused by harassment, prejudice, and discrimination. I believe that ending the silence is the first step toward fighting these injustices. Think about the voices you are not hearing today. What are you going to do to end the silence?" Some demonstrators amplified the message with T-shirts, signs hung from their necks, and even face painting. On many campuses, there were additional actions and educational forums, and most celebrated the end of silence with a group shout. Begun by then-University of Virginia student Maria Pulzetti, the Day of Silence has been entirely student-run until this year. Now organized by the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, GLSEN, this year's observance was the biggest and best publicized yet. With that increased visibility came increased protests from the religious right, including counter-demonstrations at schools in perhaps a half dozen states.
A 1994 U.S. federal hate crimes law was applied for the first time this week to a crime motivated by homophobia as a grand jury handed down an indictment in the widely reported 1996 murder of two young women hikers on the popular Appalachian Trail. The law, providing for increased sentences for bias-motivated crimes, could only be applied because the killings occurred on federal land in the Shenandoah National Park in Virginia. Other federal hate crimes laws do not yet recognize anti-gay bias motivation. While the indictment of Daryl David Rice for the murders of Julianne Williams and Lolly Winans was welcomed by those who knew the victims, it was most surprising for being announced by Attorney General John Ashcroft, a religious right activist whose appointment was vigorously opposed by most gay and lesbian political groups. He said, "We will pursue, prosecute, and punish those who attack law-abiding Americans out of hatred for who they are. Hatred is the enemy of justice, regardless of its source." He said prosecutors will seek the death penalty. Defendant Rice, currently in federal prison in Virginia for attacking another woman, reportedly said that he hates gays and found women to be more vulnerable targets.
Mississippi's Supreme Court included a prohibition against bias or prejudice based on sexual orientation in new rules of conduct for state courts that it adopted last week. The new Code of Conduct represents the most extensive revision in nearly 30 years. This week, Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund filed a complaint against George County Judge Connie Glenn Wilkerson, whose letter saying gays and lesbians belonged in mental hospitals was published in a newspaper last month.
Also acting to protect civil rights was the Allentown, Pennsylvania City Council, which last week added sexual orientation and gender identity as categories protected under its local human relations ordinance. The ordinance, which prohibits bias in areas including employment and housing, is the first in the state to protect transgenders.
There have been legal advances on the adoptions front in Canada and Scotland. The Canadian province of Newfoundland, which includes Labrador, has approved sweeping reforms to its adoptions law. The reforms will open adoptions to single people and to unmarried couples, including same-gender couples. The reforms are expected to be in place in June. The Adoption Council of Canada praised the reforms as progressive and suggested they could serve as a model for other provinces. And in a ruling that breaks new ground for Scotland, a court in Edinburgh has allowed a lesbian couple to co-adopt. co-adopt each other's biological children. One child resulted from artificial insemination after the women's relationship had begun. The other was conceived during a failed heterosexual marriage. And although his father did not contest the case, that boy now has three legal parents. The legal decision recognizes the couple and their children as a family unit, unlike a Glasgow court's recent ruling that gave a sperm donor precedence over a lesbian co-parent. The Edinburgh ruling will support the pending appeal of the Glasgow decision. While gay and lesbian groups hailed the Edinburgh ruling, religious conservatives protested vocally, often from pulpits at Sunday worship services.
And finally, openly gay British-born singer-songwriter Sir Elton John testified before a U.S. Senate committee this week. As a longtime leading world AIDS philanthropist through his Elton John AIDS Foundation, he made an impassioned plea for the U.S. government to use its unparalleled wealth to do more to help poorer nations to end the epidemic. To underscore his very serious message, the usually flamboyant entertainer appeared in a conservative black suit and simple tinted glasses. Yet Sir Elton wasn't entirely able to escape his usual role. After welcoming him with a kiss on both cheeks, Democratic Senator from New York and former First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton remarked, "I asked Committee Chairman Ted Kennedy if we couldn't just get a piano in and he could sing his testimony."
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 13th, 2002, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
According to an April 13th press release from the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission and the website gayegypt.com, an appeals court has overturned the convictions of the so-called Damanhour Five, a group of gay men who were sentenced in March to 3 years hard labor for the habitual practice of debauchery, a provision commonly used in Egypt to penalize consensual homosexual behavior. According to GayEgypt.com, several hundred Egyptian men, including 23 convicted in the notorious Queen Boat raid last November, remain in prison on similar charges. This Way Out will continue to follow this story. A little boy finds out where gays and lesbians come from later in the program. Third world gay, lesbian, bi, and trans activists get to speak for themselves in Different Rainbows, an anthology of essays recently published by Gay Men's Press. The book's editor, Peter Drucker, has been providing portraits of a diverse population in a special multi-part interview with This Way Out correspondent Michael Schembri.
In Europe and North America and in Australia, the movement has tended to confirm a certain kind of distinct lesbian gay identity, a certain kind of distinct lesbian gay community, and this pattern is not likely to catch on in the same way in much of the third world, I think.
In this week's conclusion, Drucker expands on the complexities of queer identities in the context of third world realities.
How do you think, if at all, has the September 11th attack, terrorist attack in the USA, affected the move for democracy or movement away from democracy in the Islamic world?
I think the September 11th attacks, and particularly the war, haven't done anything so far to promote democracy anywhere in the world. It's certainly felt in the Middle East, in the Islamic world, as reminiscent of the colonial era, and that reinforces all the tendencies to look back to tradition, look back to religion, look back to a distinctive identity, and be suspicious of anything that's seen as alien. All the democratic, genuinely democratic forces that I know of anywhere in the Middle East, have been opposed to the U.S. war and the NATO war. And I think that reflects their feeling that it's not going to contribute anything towards democracy. That's not to speak of the impact of the war in the countries that are waging the war, like the United States and the Western European governments that are also supporting the war. Here, there's also definitely a restrictive impact on democratic freedoms. And it also makes the climate to discuss sexuality, particularly in immigrant communities of Muslim origin, much more difficult.
Third world queer activists sometimes stressed that they have different values to the West. For instance, in Asia, I have often heard emphasized that the importance of family, of social harmony, of not making waves should take priority. Now, on the one hand, I find this understandable because especially, like, say, the family is often the only form of social and economic support available. On the other hand, I can't help but think that they are often pandering to the very same conservative and reactionary forces which oppress them.
Yeah, I think there's a distinction to be made here. To say that family is important and that you can't ignore the family is a different thing from saying that you have to simply not make waves and accept whatever the traditional family dictates. That's not the same thing. In Europe, in North America, in Australia, there's been a tendency of gay people not to critique the family, not to change the family, so much as often just to walk away from the family and carve out another way of organizing our lives in big cities. I think in most Asian countries, that's less of an option. That doesn't mean you just pretend to be straight, you just get married. It means that you have to take your family seriously, and in the long term, you can set about the process of transforming the family. And how you do that can be very culturally specific. But there are stories, for example, in the article on China in Different Rainbows, that talk about the process of having a lover gradually accepted by your parents and included within the family. These are stories that I just didn't just run across from Asia, but also from other parts of the Third World. It doesn't mean that the Third World is going to be free of conflict in this area and that everything can go smoothly or that everything can be concealed, but it does mean that the process can happen somewhat differently than it happens in, say, a country like Australia or a country like Holland.
Faisal Alam from the Western-based Muslim gay and lesbian organization Al Fatiha recently asked that if by adopting an identity, in other words, adopting a public visibility, gay men and lesbians, might they not be attracting oppression? What role do you see identity as playing, particularly in the Third World?
I think, again, that varies. There are parts of the Third World where you have had quite flourishing and even accepted forms of homosexuality that have not been linked to a gay identity. There's fascinating work that's been done on Suriname, for example, a former Dutch colony in South America, by a Dutch woman of Surinamese origin named Gloria Becker, that talks about what Afro-Surinamese women call the Mati work. And this is a form of love between women, sexual relations between women, that's very much rooted in the African cultures of this part of the world. And it hasn't meant that these women were ever particularly identified as lesbians, as women different from straight women. Generally, they have also had sex with men and had children with men. So that can exist. And I don't think we should insist that the process of sexual liberation always has to go together with the development of identity. But the non-existence of an identity certainly isn't proof of liberation. The non-existence of identity can be linked to all sorts of oppression. You don't need an identity to be oppressed. And on the other hand, you do need an identity to build a movement. And I think in most parts of the Third World, as in most parts of the world, we do need to build movements in order to free ourselves sexually. So in that sense, I think the development of identity is an important part of the process of liberation. We shouldn't be dogmatic about what forms that identity takes. You have, growing up particularly in the Third World, now all sorts of forms of transgender identity, for example, that are not exactly the same as lesbian gay identity as it's been consolidated in lesbian gay movements in rich countries in the past 30 years. You're seeing all sorts of interesting kinds of bisexual identities or whatever originating, and I think we should be open to those kinds of identities as well as part of the process of liberation.
Do you think that the developments in the Third World, in that case, offer a challenge to the Western model of reform? Its accommodation to capitalism, its seeking of respectability at the expense of more marginalized same-sex sexualities?
Mm-hmm. I do think so, or maybe I should say I should hope so, because I myself have always identified with a lesbian gay radical tradition, not a lesbian gay reformist or accommodationist tradition. So I do hope that examples from the Third World, where the possibility of forming a gay ghetto, where the possibilities of accommodation are less, can serve as a challenge, can serve as an inspiration for us around the world to breathe new life into a more radical approach to lesbian gay liberation. Now, whether that actually happens depends on developments in the broader world, and we've seen a lot in the past decade, particularly, that history can take some very surprising twists and turns that we're not able to anticipate. One thing I would very much like to see is a linkage between the anti-globalization movements that have been growing up in the past few years and lesbian gay movements. That's something we haven't seen much of yet. I think there must be a potential for it. If you look at something like the World March for Women, we see that there's been a link-up between anti-globalization movements and feminist movements around the world, particularly making the connections around issues of poverty and inequality and economic issues more generally. And I think that potential must exist within lesbian gay movements around the world, too. So I would like to see people push forward on those linkages.
That was Peter Drucker, editor of the gay men's press anthology Different Rainbows, in conversation with This Way Out correspondent Michael Schembri.
Oh, you two are so professional.
This is Susie Bright, your favorite feminist pornographer, and there's nothing more that I enjoy than listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
For some grown-ups, it might be a complicated subject, but in this fond recollection by Peter Dell, a simple question gets a simple answer, thanks to some fairy godparents.
Daddy, what does gay mean? My father blushed, a reaction I wasn't used to from a man who nothing can really shock, except that day when I was 5. The day I asked my father what the word gay meant. I looked at my brother. He was 2.5 years older. He was supposed to know this stuff already. When I looked at him, my eyebrows raised questioningly. He only shrugged. I don't know. I was in the back seat of the VW Beetle, sitting next to the paper bags filled with groceries, as my father began to explain. My brother sat in the front seat next to my dad. You remember how babies are made, right? My father began. We three men had this talk a couple of months before, when my brother asked where babies came from. I loved hearing about the birds and the bees from my dad. It had seemed mysterious and magical, this wonderful chemical reaction in this amazing product called a baby. We remember, my brother said. And you remember that when a man and a woman love each other very much, they have sex and then a baby is created? Sex. Making babies. I wanted to giggle, but I knew adults didn't giggle. Well, sometimes a man and a man love each other very much, or a woman and a woman. And if they love each other enough, they may have sex with each other. That's what being gay is. Thank you. brother and I were very quiet. Silent, in fact, taking it all in. A man and a man having sex? Or a woman and a woman? It seemed different. Strange. But a strange that could be good. Cliff and Jim, your godfathers, Peter, my dad said. They're gay. I leaned forward so I could hear better. Really? I asked. Yep, my dad said. They've been together almost 10 years now. It made sudden and obvious sense why they lived in the same house. In my mind, the analogy was made. Cliff and Jim were married. Is a lesbian a gay woman? My brother asked. In the back seat, I quietly tried out the word in my mouth. Lesbian. I made another little giggle. Lesbian, lesbian, lesbian. Yes, very good, my dad said, more to Graham than to me. Peter's godmothers, Bess and Judy, are lesbians. So Cliff and Jim and Bess and Judy are all gay? I asked. My godparents were some of my favorite adults. They treated me well and talked to me like an adult. I admired them more than many of my blood relatives. Yes, my dad said. Cliff and Bess were very good friends with me and Mommy when we first met. Then they met Jim and Judy, so now they're all your godparents. That's no fair, Graham said. I only have 2 godparents. Your godparents are very special, my dad said to Graham. Just because you only have 2 doesn't make them any less important. I want gay godparents, my brother muttered so that I could hear, but my dad couldn't. The Beetle pulled into our driveway. We all helped carry the groceries in. My mom met us in the kitchen. How was the trip to the store? She said, to no one in particular. Great, I said. We learned what gay meant. My mom seemed a little surprised, but only nodded her head. Good. Good. We unpacked groceries. Graham and I played catch out in the street. The day went on.
That was Fairy Godparents, written and read by Peter Dell and produced by Steve Pride and John Beaupre. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Alzinga, Graham Underhill, Brian Nunes, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambidge, Rex Walkner, Michael Schembri, and Peter Dell contributed program material. Thanks also to Steve Pride and John Beaupre. Omar Farouk Tekbilek performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To learn how you can help in This Way Out's struggle to stay on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WWUH West Hartford, Connecticut, KAZU Pacific Grove, California, 5RRR Woomera, South Australia, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Please stay tuned.